So much is happening in Israel every moment. What should we make of it? We'll talk about it today right here on The Line of Fire on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey friends, welcome to today's broadcast. As you can see, I'm not in our normal studio, don't have the normal Line of Fire backdrop behind me. I'm actually in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I did some recording today for Cornerstone TV Network, focusing on my new book, Playing with Holy Fire. So we had a great time with interviews, with coaching videos and things like that. And now I'm broadcasting live, but with our portable setup, all of you who've donated to the GoFundMe campaign. This is all part of your generosity towards us, which enables us to minister to you. So not only is everyone listening, as always, on radio, but you are getting to watch while I am on the road with a live feed on Facebook and elsewhere. But the same rules apply. You've got questions, we've got answers. Well, it's Thursday, so Thoroughly Jewish questions, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Also, because I'm doing this differently, I have a different screen in front of me. In fact, I've got an iPhone right in front of me, which means I'm just watching. Ron Cantor from Israel. Come on, man. You should call in the show and give me some updates, all right? But everybody watching, send me some emoji love, okay? Some cool Jewish emoji love on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Number to call again, 866-348-7884. Now listen, when we have breaks on the radio, you'll still see me here, so I'll communicate with you a little bit during the breaks as well, so we can just have a little extra Facebook fun here. Those watching on YouTube as well, bless you. Welcome to the broadcast. Before I go to the phones, I want to talk about the most major news coming from Israel, relating to Israel. The situation in Gaza remains very intense. It remains very intense. And just to give you a little history, when Israel was declared a nation and the borders set in 47, and then seven surrounding Arab nations attacked Israel in 1948, Israel fighting for its survival and really miraculously surviving and making it out of that time period. And one of the issues is now that East Jerusalem is taken over by Jordan and the city is now divided, and you have problems now that you didn't have, you know, no access to the wall for prayer and things like that. It was a difficult time in Israel's history from 48 to 67 until it was recaptured. But Gaza Strip was basically under Egyptian control. And the Egyptians, to be candid, did not have a heart to help the Palestinians. That was not their goal. And in fact, the more that you have Palestinian refugees, the worse that Israel looks, okay? So this is part of the problem that the Arab world, the surrounding Muslim world, has not had tremendous compassion on their Palestinian brethren. Not without exception. But by and large, there has not been an effort to repatriate them and say, okay, look, you were living here, you've got a neighboring country, it's a Muslim country, it's an Arabic-speaking country, come and be part of this country. No, you can go to countries like Syria or countries like Lebanon, and they have Palestinian refugee camps there in Syria and in Lebanon. Why? Because the Palestinians have not been absorbed by the surrounding populations, and as they've had a high birth rate as well, you have more and more of these refugees. So Gaza Strip, after war, came under Israeli control. And that meant that the Palestinians living there, the Arabs living there, primarily Muslim, were now under Israeli control and under Israeli authority. But there was an effort to live together as neighbors, as there were more and more settlers in Gaza, Jewish settlers in Gaza. But under pressure from the United States and believing it was the best thing to do, Ariel Sharon pulled out of Gaza. many of the leaders in Israel were generals, were warriors. They're even fighting an underground resistance like Menachem Begin and things like that. Yitzhak Shamir at the founding of Israel. They were in underground troops trying to oust the British and fight the Arabs and things like that. A lot of these guys, when they became leaders, they were hardline. Youngman Cho, awesome man. What an amazing work you're doing there with the gospel in Africa. So proud of you there and the years you served in India. I don't normally get to see all the names. So my apologies, everyone listening on radio, who am I talking to? Just all of our viewers that are tuning in from around the world, watching on Facebook now. But anyway, a lot of these hardened generals, warriors, as they got older, thought, we've got to just find a peaceful solution. War is only going to go so far. Or we can pull back a little and we can make room and things will work out. So under pressure from the States, Ariel Sharon said, we're going to exit Gaza. We're going to exit Gaza. And what happened was there was the forcible removal of several thousand Israelis living there. What was it, 8,000, 10,000? Forcible removal. They'd been living there for years and years. They had vineyards there. They had farms there. They had beautiful synagogues they had built. They had houses there. They were forcefully evacuated by the Israeli army. It was a very traumatic time for Israel. Now they're living in tents and things like that in Israel. And now it's given over to Palestinian rule and authority. What do? They elect Hamas. They elect Hamas as their leadership. And now you've got a sworn enemy of the people, a sworn enemy who says that their goal is to annihilate the Jewish people in Israel, to drive them out of the land. Now that is run by Hamas. And remember, Hamas does a lot of humanitarian things for the people, and they've had social programs, and that's why they're also loved by some of the population. But in any case, you now have a terrorist government over Gaza. Because of that, Gaza has been blockaded. Why? Because Israel does not want weapons being shipped in. They were being shipped in by tunnel from Egypt, and the Egyptians didn't want that. So they've been squeezed in. Israel lets humanitarian aid in every day, but basically they have a hostile government. I want you to hear what Geraldo Rivera had to say. This is Geraldo Rivera talking about Gaza, because recently there were protests that were staged against Israel. Israel lashed out, fought back with shooting at some of the protesters. It was there are borders you don't cross over. You don't cross over these borders. And when you do cross over, this security zone here, you're going to be shot. So there are a number of casualties. And of course, all the anti-Israel crowd saying, look at this, you're just butchering people. And others say, well, you're just staging a protest and you're violating rules. What do you expect to happen? Listen to what Geraldo Rivera had to say. Clip number one. We'll listen to this first as he's talking about Gaza as the world's largest concentration camp. Do we have it? Maybe we don't. Okay. We'll check on that and come back to it. But you've got some real strong criticism. You've got some real hostility. Israel now being painted as the bad guy. But listen, here's the deal. If you didn't have corrupt leadership over the people, if all of the international aid that goes pouring into the Palestinians, okay? If so much of it was not spent to build terror tunnels to penetrate Israel, if so much of it was not being built and being used for weapons against Israel, the people's quality of life would be massively, massively, massively better. Israel would gladly dwell in peace with its neighbors if its neighbors were not trying to murder them. Let's see what would actually happen if there was the real renunciation of terror in the heart and part of the Palestinians. And there are enough Israelis that don't like the way the government runs things and feel the Palestinians are being abused and taken advantage of and hurt and oppressed. There's enough voices like that within Israel. Israel's a democratic nation, and you've got all kinds of voices being sounded. But bottom line, the biggest problems in Gaza are the fault of Hamas. Bottom line, I'm not justifying everything Israel does, but I'm saying this plainly. The biggest problems in Gaza are the fault of Hamas. All right, let us get some calls. 866-34-TRUTH. We'll start in Phoenix, Arizona with Jamar. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown, for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I have a question in regards to operating, or how would you, what advice would you give in relation to seeking like a Jewish combined ministry? I'm a licensed and ordained clergy myself, and I was seeking more of the Jewish roots of my faith, and I believe the Lord is, you know, calling me more into a pastoral ministry. I wanted to ask if you can offer any advice on how would you operate that, or pretty much how you do it, as I know you attribute with your church. I believe you lift up like a little information on your church. I think yours is on Sunday. I think you stated before that you operated, or you did, with the Messianic Jewish as well. I wanted to ask you for advice for that.
All right. So are you talking about just generically, or within your own church, you want to be involved in Jewish ministry?
Generically.
All right. So generically, first thing you always start with any ministry you do, with a genuine burden. You want to have a heart for the people. It's not just a mission or a statistic. You want to have the heart for it, right? So I would strongly encourage folks, if they haven't, to read Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, to read my book about the church and the Jewish people, and to really get an understanding of church history through Jewish eyes, and how Jesus often appears through Jewish eyes, and what the Jewish people have suffered through the ages, and yet God's heart for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So I'd start there and say, God, break my heart with your heart. Share your heart with me. That's the first thing. That's where I'd start. That's number one. Number two, I would look for opportunities to get to know Jewish people in my community. I'd ask for divine appointments. I'd say, Father, bring me in contact with different Jewish people. And then you just get to know them like anyone else. You build a relationship so you can share the gospel. A third thing is that everyone can pray for the salvation of Israel. Even if you don't live in a large Jewish neighborhood, or you don't feel particularly called to Jewish ministry, everyone can pray for the salvation of Jewish people. That's very important. And then every church can support Jewish outreach. Paul did write in Romans 1:16, the gospel is to the Jew first and also to the Gentile. So I believe it's a divine priority still to bring the gospel to Jewish people. So pray for God's burden and heart, get educated there, pray for divine appointments to share the gospel, pray for the salvation of Jewish people, and then support Jewish outreach ministries. We are one of those, but support Jewish outreach ministries. All right, we'll be back. Much more to come on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. This is Michael Brown, enjoying the voice of my dear friend, Anointed Worship Leader Paul Wilbur. Man, we got to do some meetings together. All right, if you've got a Jewish-related question, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348. Wait, did I give the wrong number? That's just a test to see if you're listening. 866-34-TRUTH. Hey, Craig, thanks for posting that in Hebrew, Ashrei Adam, Oz Lo Bach. So blessed is the man whose strength is found in you. James asks a question here on Facebook. What defines a saved Jew? Is it his acceptance of Jesus? Yes, Jews are saved like everybody else. Jews are saved the same way everyone else is, through faith in Jesus, the Messiah. We don't have a separate covenant. Some people represent it. They misteach that, well, Jews have their own covenant with God. Well, hang on. Why then did Jesus come to the lost sheep of the house of Israel? If Jews already had a covenant with God, why did Jesus come to the lost sheep of the house of Israel first and foremost? And why were all of his disciples Jewish? And why did he say that the good news had to be preached beginning in Jerusalem to all nations, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and then the ends of the earth? Why, pray tell, did he say that? Did he do that if Jews already had a covenant with God? Why not just go to the Gentiles? No, it's to the Jew first, because he is the Messiah, and there is no salvation found outside of him. This is an article, April 1st, Israel-Palestine News by Gideon Levy, the Israel Massacre Forces. And he says, the death counter ticked away wildly. This is originally published in Haaretz, which is a left-wing Israeli publication. One death every 30 minutes. Again, another one. One more. Israel was busy preparing for the Seder night. TV stations continued broadcasting their nonsense. It's not hard to imagine what would have happened if a settler had been stabbed. On-site broadcasts throw open the studios. But in Gaza, the Israel Defense Forces continue to massacre mercilessly with horrific rhythm as Israel celebrated Passover. This is a critical left-wing voice within Israel. You must understand, Israel is not monolithic. You have a certain percentage of the population, the ultra-Orthodox, some of them don't even believe in the modern state of Israel being from God, all right? They believe it's getting in the way of the Messiah coming and setting up his kingdom, all right? So you have them living there, and they don't serve in the military either. Then you have the left-wing voices that are hypercritical of Israel. Your average American evangelical Christian is much more pro-Israel and supportive of Israel than the left-wing voices within Israel. So in response to that, you have, for example, I'm looking on Israel National News, which is a right-wing Israel website, that the public security minister, Gilad Erdan, on his Facebook page, responded to B'Tselem. B'Tselem is a strong left-wing organization in Israel, and they called on soldiers, don't go to Gaza, don't go near Gaza, and don't obey orders. If you're being ordered to go there and shoot, you know, look, Israel has a rule. You cannot cross the security zone. If you do, you'll be shot. And when people cross that zone, they were shot. That did happen. That's the harsh reality of things. So here now is an Israeli leader criticizing the left-wing Israelis, saying, what in the world are you doing? So the article says, so now it turns out that while our soldiers are guarding southern communities during the holiday, some delusional radical leftists, because of the holiday spirit, I won't add, enemies of Israel, are sitting in the air conditioning office of B'Tselem in Tel Aviv, giving instructions to soldiers in the field, no less. They expect our soldiers to listen to their protocols for not opening fire and not to the chief of staff's orders. So listen carefully, B'Tselem. So this is a conservative Israeli, a right-wing Israeli, responding to left-wing Israelis. So listen carefully, B'Tselem. I understand that you have to justify the salaries that you receive, including those from the New Israel Fund and the European Union. But this error in which you preach morality to Israeli society while we remain humbly silent is over. And he says, if the Palestinians in Gaza were important to you, you would call on Hamas to take care of them instead of using their money to finance concrete for terror tunnels. In other words, you're getting upset with the Israelis for enforcing laws of security, even if it means Palestinian casualties, but you're not upset with Hamas squandering hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars building terror tunnels under Israel to try to destroy and kidnap and kill Israelis. You're not protesting that while Palestinians are being deprived of good housing and good jobs and their economy is in the pits. It's not Israel's fault. So let's just be even-handed. But just so you understand, within Israel, there are Israeli professors calling for the boycott of Israel. Israel has extreme left voices as well as extreme right voices. What we need to do as followers of Jesus is recognize God indeed has restored the Jewish people back to the land. God indeed has done that. That is a sovereign work of God. Yes, work through man, but God has done it. At the same time, Israel needs to be held accountable. So God has done a great work of restoration supernaturally. The one who scattered is the one who has regathered. At the same time, Israel needs to be held accountable, and Israel, of all nations, should be called to act justly and rightly with their neighbors. I don't see why we can't do both things simultaneously. 866-34-TRUTH. Why can't we recognize, A, God has restored the Jewish people, B, Jewish people need to be held accountable like everyone else. Why can't we do both at the same time? All right, back to the phones. We go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Frank, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Well, hello, Dr. Brown, and I praise God for the ministry that God has given you to give answers to difficult questions. I just want to explain to you and to have you comment about this in Ephesians chapter 2.
Yeah.
Actually, it begins in verse 14 of chapter 2 verse 16.
Yes,
and
in Ephesians 2.
There are four words that are in that. One is creating the one new man to abolish the hostility or enmity and then establish shalom because he's our peace. What kind of, what do you see in that?
Yes, sir.
That
very
is
important.
Actually, is the hostility diminishing, or what is he talking about?
Yeah, so let me explain. He talks about the middle wall of partition that divided. And you have to remember, the temple in Jerusalem had different courts, all right? There was the court
Correct.
Of the Gentiles, and the Gentiles could only go so far. And there it was written in several languages. You go past here under penalty of death, and then the court of the women, etc., right? So
yes.
Gentiles were excluded. They could not enter the temple in Jerusalem like a Jew could. You had that literal wall of partition. And you also had various Jewish traditions and laws that developed that further separated Jew from Gentile and even created hostility. And of course, there was Gentile hostility towards Jew and Jewish hostility towards Gentile. All right, so in Jesus, that wall of partition disappears. So amazingly enough, I mean, we're used to it, but amazingly enough, Jew and Gentile as one can come together into the presence of God and can have equal standing. Here's a Jew, here's a Gentile, and equally be children of God, equally be members of the body, equally be vines of the branch, equally be priests to God, no class status, no caste status, amazingly equal in God's sight. That is extraordinary. And yet a Jew does not become a Gentile and a Gentile does not become a Jew. How do a husband and wife become one? Do they become one by the man stop being a man, the woman stop being a woman, or the man as a man and the woman as a woman come together as one, and in their uniqueness, their similarities and their differences, they come together as one? So that's how we find union, Frank. We don't find union by Gentiles trying to become Jews or Jews trying to become Gentiles. We have certain things in common and certain foundations in common and a common spiritual heritage and one God and one Messiah. And we may want to participate in the same calendar. That's going to be worked out differently. But we come together as one new man by recognizing our unity in Jesus and recognizing our unity in our distinctives. That's the beautiful harmony that we enjoy. So sometimes this is expressed by a church having a tremendous heart for the Jewish people. Sometimes it's expressed by a Gentile believer being part of a Messianic Jewish congregation. It can be expressed through a church praying especially during the Passover season for the salvation of Jewish people. It can be expressed by a joint meal that's had together. It can be expressed in various different ways. So that has to be worked out. The key thing is mutual honor, mutual respect, and recognition that we find unity in the midst of our distinctives, just like a man and woman come together as one. So the middle wall that divided us is no longer there through the Messiah. And what would seem totally radical in the ancient world is now normal for us through the gospel. 866-34-TRUTH. Tell you what. Before I go back to the phones, let me just share a couple other things with you, and then we'll go to the phones right on the other side of the break on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If you're just tuning in and you're watching on Facebook or YouTube or watching on your app on your phone, you'll notice a different setting. I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's snowing. Come on, 28 degrees and snowing. What is it? It's April 5th. 28 degrees and snowing when I got up today to go to a TV studio to do some shows on my book, Playing with Holy Fire. But please pray for me. I'm going to be part of a special Jewish outreach taking place next month. Can't say more than that. But please pray for real fruit and effectiveness. And then I'm going to be in May in Bethlehem, all right, at the end of May, for the Christ at the Checkpoint Conference. I have been invited to go as a dissenting voice. I have opposed this conference. I have differed with this conference. I have spoken against this conference. So I am not going as an endorser, but as a dissenter. That's why I've been asked to go. So pray that as we bring some very strong messages, one in particular, that God would give ears to hear and that I would hear what I need to hear. All right, we'll be right back.
It's fire we want, for fire we please.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
There we go. That same song again. We heard it earlier. We're hearing it again. Welcome, welcome to the broadcast. Everyone just tuning in. So glad to have you. It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. And I just see a note here by Michael on our Facebook feed. My Pentecostal Assemblies of Canada Bible College is now ordering Authentic Fire. Awesome. Wonderful. You'll find that book helpful, edifying. Hey, friends, any Jewish-related questions you have, the phone lines are now open. 866-34-TRUTH. Before I go to the phones, just want to mention to you some really significant developments. The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, that's his nickname for his initials. He has basically said, yeah, Israel has a right to exist. They have a right to a homeland and just need to have arrangements for a homeland for the Palestinians. And so, you know, two-state solution. But it's extremely rare. It's unprecedented, really, for a leader of his stature in the Muslim world to say what he said, in Saudi Arabia in particular. There's an article on Times of Israel by Khaled Abu Tomeh. Palestinian terror groups seethe over Saudi Crown Prince's pro-Israel comments. And he notes that Palestinian terror groups on Wednesday accused Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of paving the way for normalization between the Arab countries and Israel. Salman, in an interview published Monday, recognized Israel's right to exist and extolled the prospect of future diplomatic relations between his kingdom and the Jewish state. His remarks, which have enraged many Palestinians and Arabs, were made during an interview with The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg. Asked whether he believes, quote, the Jewish people have a right to a nation state in at least part of their ancestral homeland, he replied, I believe that each people anywhere has a right to live in their peaceful nation. I believe the Palestinians and the Israelis have a right to have their own land. That's a massive statement for the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia. The article states the Palestinian Authority chose to ignore Salman's remarks in an apparent attempt to avoid triggering a crisis between Ramallah and Riyadh. In a move designed to stave off such a crisis and to relay a message to the effect that the Palestinians were keen to remain on good terms with Saudi Arabia, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas on Tuesday expressed appreciation for the Saudi monarch's, his father, for his fixed and constant support for the Palestinian cause and Jerusalem's holy sites, and ignored what the son had said. Very, very interesting. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Reese in New Brunswick, Canada. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing well, thank you.
Good. I'm wondering if I can ask about Judges 13:18. What's happening with the Hebrew there? My name is, why do you ask my name, seeing as it is wonderful?
Mm-hmm.
I've seen other translations as well. And then if you have time, if not, that's fine. But I was also wondering about David's census in 2 Samuel and why that was considered bad, seeing as the same thing happened in Numbers.
Yeah. So in Judges 13:18, the Hebrew word there is pele. And pele is also used in Isaiah 9:6. We know it is wonderful. Pele yoetz el gibor avi atzar shalom. So pele there, wonderful. Pele yoetz, wonderful counselor, or a wonder of a counselor. So normally it's translated, or sometimes translated, why are you asking, seeing that it's wonderful. However, some, with fair basis, understand wonderful there to mean it's beyond your comprehension. It's beyond your knowing. So I'm looking at the Hebrew, but then as I look at the Greek, it's marvelous, wonderful. New Jewish Version, the Tanakh version, it's unknowable. The NET, you cannot comprehend it. NIV, it's beyond understanding. So it's a legitimate debate. Should it be said it's wonderful? But what does it mean? Like wonderful, like wow, really cool, or wonderful beyond you? Certainly wonderful beyond you. As for the census, you'll notice that Israel had to actually pay a tax, and it was a census tax, and that immediately after the numbering of people, it at the end of Numbers, when they count to see how many troops went out into battle and came back, they immediately want to put an offering together to stave off judgment and wrath. So we know that there were God-ordained censuses, but otherwise somehow to bring people under this authority or under this power or be counted somehow expose them to wrath or danger. It's an interesting subject, and maybe one I'll do a show where I talk about it greater length. So I'm not doing justice in my answer, but with phone lines jammed, I'm just trying to go one question at a time. So that's another one I'll come back to. It's a bigger question. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Kyle in Vero Beach, Florida. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, thanks for taking my phone call.
Sure thing.
So I came into contact with a Jewish objection to the book of Galatians, or mm-hmm. it's actually an objection to Paul. Mm-hmm. And it says in Galatians 3:16 that the promises were spoken to Abraham and his seed, that Scripture does not say, and to seed, meaning many people, but and to your seed, meaning one person who is Christ. And the objection that I came into came to was that they were saying that Paul was being deceptive, because in the original Hebrew there's no word for seed, and so therefore, you know, the argument that he's making isn't valid. If you know what I mean.
Yeah. So to make this clear to everyone, Paul, let's use the word offspring, like the ESV does, right? That he says to Abraham and his offspring. He doesn't say offsprings, but offspring. We don't say offsprings. We don't use that term, right? We say offspring, singular, and it's a collective singular. Well, Paul knew that because it's the same in Greek. And the Galatians knew that. And Paul in Romans 4, verses 13 through 18, uses the Greek sperma collectively, okay? Paul 100% understood that it was a collective singular. And in Galatians 3:29, he says, if you belong to Messiah, then you are Abraham's sperma. You are Abraham's seed. So he uses it collectively in the very same chapter. And he uses it collectively in Romans 4, and then in Romans 9, and in Romans 11. So Paul fully understood the collective use, as did the Galatians, because that's how it was used in Greek as well, that sperma seed could be used as offspring in general. What Paul was actually doing was using rabbinic hermeneutics. He was using rabbinic micro-reading of a text. And there are actual examples in the Talmud where it will distinguish between one seed and another, or the seed spoken of is Isaac, or the seed spoken of is the Messiah. So all he's doing is telling they fully understand the point, okay, that it's a collective singular. But he's noticing, he's drawing attention to the fact that it is a singular. So how is it that blessing comes to the whole world? Because the promise was through Abraham's seed, the whole world is blessed. Who is that through? Through the Messiah. So God's purposes for the corporate nation, for the plural seed, are fulfilled through the singular seed. So he wasn't telling them anything they didn't know, but his whole argument was the Galatians thought they had to become Jewish, that the Galatians thought the men had to be circumcised and everyone had to obey the law of Moses in order to be saved. And it would be Abraham's children. He said, no, you're children of Abraham by faith. And you don't need to be Jewish. You need to be in the Messiah. If you're in him, then you're in the singular seed among the collective seed. So number one, Paul understood what it meant. In context, he uses it collectively as well. He assumed his readers knew what it meant. It's no different in Greek than it was in Hebrew usage. And not only so, did Paul not know all of the verses? Did the Galatians not know all of the verses where God says, I'll make your seed like the sands of the seashore, like the stars of the sky? So of course they knew that, but he was highlighting the fact that it is fulfilled through one particular seed. So using a rabbinic type of reading of the text, I've just finished a scholarly article on that very subject. I've been completely immersed in that for weeks now. So it is, you know what, it's like saying It's like saying that I actually didn't understand something about my name, Brown, when I said they call me Brown because they call me Mike because I use the mic. Notice it says my. No, I know that my name does not mean my. We understand that. So it's that silly to say Paul didn't understand. And again, in that very chapter, he uses it collectively, and the Galatians would have understood that as well.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, and I'll look forward to reading that article.
Yeah, sure thing. Sounds good. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Mike in Delavan, Wisconsin. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown. First off, what's that really cool song that you go to during the breaks? I want to hear the whole thing.
Oh, so during the breaks when we fade out every day.
Change the world.
That's written by Aaron Kreider, who's a graduate from Brownsville Revival School of Ministry. It now serves at Gateway Church in Dallas on the worship team there. And that is called Shake the Nations.
Ah, okay.
Every year, we have a missions conference. We just had our 17th annual missions conference last year. This is for the missionaries that have come out from our ministry that we support and cover around the world. And for one of the missions conferences, he used to be our worship leader, Dr. Josh Peters, who's our missions director, said, Aaron, I want you to write a new song for the conference. And God gave Aaron that song. So it's great. It's a Jesus Revolution Shake the Nations song. That's the name of it. Shake the Nations, Aaron Kreider, Kreider.
Okay. Second question.
Yep.
And since it's Jewish.
Yeah.
Jewish Thursday. I get this all the time. I am pro Land of Israel. I'm somewhat of a Calvinist because I believe providentially it was given to the Jews because it's their land, and not to the Palestinians. And to call it Palestine, in my humble opinion, is a slap in the face of the Almighty. However, I always come up with I get this objection all the time. And it's Genesis chapter 10, and you're probably very familiar with it, but here it is. In the King James, of course, because this is where the understanding,
people get
this understanding.
Yeah, what verse?
Verse 2 on through 5. The sons of Japheth, Gomer, and Magog, and Madai, and Javan, and Tubal, and Meshech, and Tavas.
Right, tell you what, just for time's sake, because we're going to hit a break, let me get the question out, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz. And it says the sons of Japheth, and then verse 5, and calls them all Gentiles.
Got it. So Ashkenaz there is completely unrelated, 100% unrelated to Ashkenazi Jews today. It's an ancient people, completely unrelated to Ashkenazi Jews today. Very simple answer. Thanks.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire. You can see a different setting here. I'm broadcasting from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. But everyone that is watching, if you're listening on radio, you're thinking, well, what do you mean, as you can see? Well, if you're watching on our Facebook live feed or our YouTube feed, you see a different background here, and I look different mic. It's because I'm out on the road. But we are now able to do a high-quality video stream of the broadcast. So everyone listening on radio, same quality, but now we've added in video stream thanks to your generosity and standing with us. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go over to Cyprus Coast. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Michael, I just want to say first my thanks and express my respect. I've got a number of books of you. What I very kindly wish to ask you is, what is the link between the Hebrew calendar, Aleph and so on, and the Phoenician and the Greek alphabet? Mm-hmm. I'm sure you know the idea that the accusation, in fact, that has been levied that the Jewish calendar did not pre-exist the Greek or Phoenician.
Yeah, I think you mean alphabet, not calendar, alphabet.
Yeah, that's right. I would very much like to know your view on this.
Sure. So, thanks for the call and the kind words all the way over from the amazing island of Cyprus. Okay, I have a full-length video about the origins of the alphabet, how it developed, separating myth from fact, the Hebrew alphabet. If you go to my website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org, if you'll go there and then just type in the word paleo, P-A-L-E-O, paleo, we will go back through the history of the alphabet, the development of the alphabet, and separate myth from fact there. The earliest Semitic alphabet that we have is the so-called Proto-Sinaitic inscriptions. And these are, some have argued, one scholar claims that these were written by the Israelites when they were captive in Egypt or about that time frame, and it's the oldest. Others just call it the Proto-Sinaitic alphabet. And that ultimately develops into the alphabet, which we call the Phoenician alphabet, all right? The Phoenician alphabet with 22 characters. That is the alphabet that was also used by the Hebrews, because Hebrew and Phoenician are both Canaanite dialects. So in ancient Semitic languages, for example, you have East Semitic, that would be Babylonian and Assyrian. You have North Semitic, the Northwest Semitic, Aramaic is part of that, or that can even be Northeast part of Aramaic. Then Northwest Semitic would be Hebrew and Phoenician and Ugaritic. And then South West Semitic would be Arabic and things like that. And then different parts of Southeast. All these are Semitic dialects. I said more than I needed to say. Sorry about that. Okay, so Hebrew and Phoenician share the same alphabet. Some scholars believe, it's normally believed that the Hebrews borrowed the Phoenician alphabet, and then that alphabet we know was also borrowed by the Greeks. That's why the beginning letters of the Hebrew alphabet are Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet. The beginning letters of the Greek alphabet are Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta. So they all have the same origins. And then ultimately, when the Jewish people, the people of Judah, were in Babylonian exile, they picked up the square script, the Aramaic script, and that's the script that's primarily used today. That older script called the Paleo script has not been used for many centuries. So yes, it was the same alphabet originally used by the Hebrews and the Phoenicians, probably developed by the Phoenicians. Some want to argue it's developed by the Hebrews. Either way, shared the same alphabet, and that was the alphabet that was then borrowed by the Greeks because it was really a groundbreaking alphabet, and then they had to modify them. The Greek alphabet had to add other letters that weren't covered in the Hebrew. The Hebrew alphabet had to, or Phoenician alphabet, had to use certain consonants for two or three different sounds because you didn't have enough different letters. So everything has been adopted. There was no perfect alphabet for either. These were adopted. But again, go to askdrbrown.org, and then just type in paleo, where it says search, P-A-L-E-O, and I put it all up in graphics and everything. You can see it all. Thank you, sir, for the question. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Anton in New Orleans. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown, for taking my call today. My question, each year I read through the scriptures, and this year I'm reading through one that's based on the Septuagint. And I'm seeing a study note that talks about following the Bar Kokhba rebellion in 135, the Jewish rabbis made a strong effort to purge the Septuagint of references that could be interpreted as referring to Christ as Messiah. And I'm just wondering some history on that or where I could go to get more reading. I, you know, Googled it and stuff, but I really haven't been able to find anything to kind of back up this note.
Yeah, what Bible are you reading from?
It's the Orthodox Study Bible this year.
Right, so it's Greek Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox?
I'm thinking it's Greek, but that's all that's written on it is Orthodox Study Bible.
Right, and it's, okay, and it has all the Septuagint books in it? It has.
Yes, it does.
Oh, okay, got it. All right. So that is a speculative argument. The Bar Kokhba revolt, which was put down by the Romans in 135 AD, was a horrifically bloody revolt. The Jewish soldiers made a lot of progress and then were terribly crushed, and it led to the expulsion of Jews from Jerusalem. All right. Now, the traditional Jewish scriptures embrace the five books of Moses and the Septuagint. They believe that those were supernaturally and divinely inspired, and the literature rejects the rest of the Septuagint translation as uninspired and full of error. That's what the Talmud says. That's what traditional Jewish literature says. The idea that there was now an attempt to purge Septuagintal references that could point to Jesus as the Messiah after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, I could not give you any substantial argument to back that. If it's out there, I'm unaware of it. Doesn't mean it's not out there, but I don't know the full basis of that note. So either the note is an error, or it's exaggerated, or I'm simply unaware of where it's coming from. Now, what we do know is that there was an attempt, and this is before the Bar Kokhba revolt, to have other Jewish translations into Greek. So, for example, the Aquila version, that was a Jewish translation into Greek that was recognized by the traditional Jews. In other words, it was not considered to be good for the Christians. You had Symmachus, you had Theodotion, you had these others. So there were different competitors to the Septuagint as far as ancient Greek translations, and others outside of the five books of Moses that different traditional Jewish communities embraced. And when I say traditionals, they were growing in their tradition, and they rejected the rest of the Septuagint. But if you find out anything to back that, great. Again, I don't want to – if it's in a study Bible – normally, there's good work and good scholarship behind that, and it doesn't, it takes a lot to put a study Bible out. So I don't want to discount that. I just question how accurate that is, or it could just be something that I've heard in different contexts and haven't studied well, and I need to brush up and find out a little bit more about that as well. That being said, it's very speculative to know exactly what transpires when, because some of the traditional Jewish literature is compiled over a period of hundreds and hundreds of years. So you don't know exactly when the thing took shape and form. Do I have time for one more call? Let's just see here. All right. Tell you what, we'll go to Charlotte, North Carolina. Reginald, if you can dive right into your question, that would be great.
Okay, how you doing, Dr. Brown?
Doing well, thank you.
Everything you're saying, but I just want to ask you one question. I'm 50-something years old. Every time somebody talks about Paul and how we all Gentiles are drafted in, it's something I must add because you're right on point. Don't forget about Stephen, the prophet, when he was stoned. People forget about it. I hear plenty of preachers preach about Paul, but wasn't for Stephen being stoned, we wouldn't have never been drafted in as Gentiles. And I think that's wonderful because when Christ stood up on the throne, the right hand throne of the Father, in majesty, he stood up and he turned around. In kingdom talk, when the head man like that stands up, something serious going on.
Yeah, and tell you what, I gotta jump in. I love your spirit and your enthusiasm, but I'm at the end of the show here. I gotta jump in. But listen, it was God's 100% plan from day one for Jews and Gentiles to be together in one body. That was his 100% plan. We know that. It was quite a shock when he began to unfold it. And to me, one of the most important things that happens with the martyrdom of Stephen is that the church, the believers, were taught to pray for those who persecute you. And because Saul of Tarsus was the ringleader of the persecution, Saul of Tarsus, Paul the Apostle, was the ringleader of the persecution, that you got to understand this, when he has Stephen killed and it helps provoke that or is part of that, all right, and then leads persecution against others, he must have been the number one guy that they prayed for. And of course, God radically saves him, and then he becomes this great Jewish teacher, the apostle to the Gentiles. All right, friends, we're out of time. I hope you enjoyed this special broadcast from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Back in studio tomorrow. You've got questions, we've got answers. Be blessed.